My name is Jeff Seaman with Search Ministries, and we want to welcome you to another edition of Straight Talk. One of the things that we have done as a mission is what we're doing here this morning, and that is periodically to have Straight Talk breakfast. Someone said years ago that the heart can't accept what the mind rejects. So the purpose of these Straight Talks is really to provoke thinking, to bring some of the, we think, the best thinkers from around the country and provide a perspective on an issue relevant to modern men and women from a biblical perspective as some food for thought. And I think this morning we've got someone who will do exactly that. Greg Kokel is the founder and president of Stand to Reason, an outstanding organization headquartered in Southern California. Greg and I are alumni of Simon Greenleaf School of Law, and where Greg and I both got masters in apologetics. Greg has lived in Southern California for quite a number of years, hails from Chicago, but has a weekly radio talk show host that he's been doing in Southern California for 17 years. He's written a number of books. He's spoken all over the world. He's been featured in a number of TV debates and newspaper articles in such prestigious journals as CBN, the British Broadcasting Network, U.S. News and World Report, and the L.A. Times. A big hand, and as he welcomes.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you. Thank you very much. Good morning. I'm here this morning because my life has been deeply influenced by an ancient teacher. His name is Jesus of Nazareth. And as I considered his explanation of things, his view of the world, his understanding of reality, I came to the conclusion that he got it right. Now, I could be wrong about this, but I've given it a lot of thought. And as a result, I've chosen these last 33 years to follow him and then to take what he believed to be true and do the best that I could to make sense of that to a world that largely has gone in the other direction. But I'll tell you, though I'm a follower of Christ, I'm not here to convert you today. I actually have a much more modest goal. I just want to put a stone in your shoe. I want you hobbling out of here this morning kind of annoyed in a good way about something that I said, because I've come to the conviction over the last 33 years that Christianity is worth thinking about. And I hope to give you something worth thinking about this morning. But there's been a trend, I think, that has kept people from giving Christianity fair consideration recently, and that's what I'd like to talk to you about this morning. I want to address this trend that I don't think has been at all good for our communities, and certainly not good for discussion about spiritual things. The discourse actually in the public square has become increasingly shrill, even in some cases ill-tempered, especially when religious issues are involved. I understand this comes from both sides of the aisle, no question about that. But I think the hostility of late has been particularly strong against what has been termed the religious right, probably better, more accurately known as evangelical Christians, who are viewed by many, and increasingly so, as dangerous to liberty in this country. I think the fear is unfounded. And I think it's been perpetuated by a very particular confusion in our culture, and I want to suggest why that's the case and how we might better, as citizens and public servants and members of our community, change this environment. And at the heart of the confusion, I think, is a confusion about the issue of tolerance, and that's what I'd like to address this morning. To give you an idea how awkward this has become, I occasionally get invited to breakfasts like this that are really more community prayer breakfast type events, so there is a kind of a religious element that's built into this, but it's awkward to come to these and give a kind of a invocation, which is a prayer, because people who have my persuasion have been invited to give prayers, and then they've given their prayer. And they've ended with statements like, "In Jesus' name, amen," which is the standard way of ending that for a Christian. And then people have gotten upset because they've considered intolerant. And I found that now when I do these things, I have to, in the present context, I've got to offer a disclaimer. And the disclaimer I offer goes something like this. I understand that prayers at events like these can be controversial. The pressure is great to offer an invocation that everyone will be comfortable with. But since there's a large diversity of beliefs and non-beliefs here, I realize that simply isn't possible. Therefore, since I've been asked to offer a prayer this morning, and since I'm a Christian, I plan to pray in a way that's consistent with my conscience, and you are welcome to enter in if you like, or simply quietly wait for me to finish as you wish, and I'll thank you in advance for your understanding and your tolerance if your particular way of praying or not praying, as the case may be, is different from mine. And such qualifiers have been necessary because people are so quick to jump nowadays. Of course, this kind of thing is rather mild, what I just described, compared to what's been happening lately. In 2001, in the New York Times, November 27th, I read an article written by Thomas Friedman. And Friedman is one of the cognoscenti of this country. He is a significant thinker, especially on issues dealing with the Middle East. And he wrote in response to what happened at 9/11, and the smoke was still billowing from the Twin Towers at the time when he wrote this. And here's what he said, and I want you to pay attention to the tone that he's setting for the culture in the comment here. He says, if 9/11 was indeed the onset of World War III, we have to understand what this war is about. We're not fighting to eradicate terrorism. Terrorism is just a tool. We're fighting to defeat an ideology. And what is that ideology? He coins the term religious totalitarianism. World War II and the Cold War were fought to defeat secular totalitarianism, Nazism, and communism. And World War III is a battle against religious totalitarianism. And here's his definition now. A view of the world that my faith must reign supreme and can be affirmed and held passionately only if all others are negated. In other words, what is religious totalitarianism to Thomas Friedman is an exclusivist view, a view that your religious point of view is the correct one and others, insofar as they differ, are incorrect. And he then applauds a rabbi who, as he puts it, set up his own schools in Israel, excuse me, to compete with fundamentalist Jews, Muslims, and Christians who use their schools to preach exclusivist religious visions. So according to Thomas Friedman, who is the real enemy now in this new battle that we're fighting, this Third World War? The real enemy is exclusivist religious visions. And Friedman adds, the future of the world may well be decided by how we fight this war. Now, this was the very first time that I'd ever heard that people like me, an evangelical Christian, who has considered the facts as best as I'm able and come to the conclusion that Jesus of Nazareth got it right, and therefore that puts his view in opposition to the worldviews of the time. I didn't think this was unusual, given that the first commandment, it says the same thing in the Ten Commandments. There is a true God and the others are false gods, and we should honor the true one. And it seems like our culture has accepted that to be a part of Christianity. But since Friedman raised this issue, identifying people like me as dangerous, many other people have picked up the cue. In fact, just recently, Rosie O'Donnell, on her new show, The View, in mid-September, in response to fellow co-host Elizabeth Hasselbeck's comment that militant Islam is a grave threat, O'Donnell states, radical Christianity is just as threatening as radical Islam in a country like America. Many Western liberals, he writes, and secular types look at the zealotry closing in on them and draw an obvious conclusion. Religion is the problem. When the President of the United States and Iran speak as much about God as about diplomacy, we have entered a newly dangerous era. Now, he has a solution here. There is a way out, he writes, and the way out is what he calls a spiritual humility and a sincere religious doubt. In other words, the way to escape the danger that is being faced in the world by the Ahmadinejads and the George Bushes of the world is to abandon the idea that your religious views are actually true, to adopt kind of a fantasy land approach to religion. Now, these articles have all kinds of things wrong with them, the cherry-picking, ignoring the vast majority of so-called religious fundamentalists who do a great, great good precisely because of their confidence that their religious views are true, and this was Bill O'Reilly's point. the problem of lumping all fundamentalists into one group regardless of belief. What matters, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, is not that someone thinks his view is true, but what they think is actually true. I mean, there are fundamentalist Christians, fundamentalist Muslims, fundamentalist atheists, fundamentalist Darwinists, fundamentalist capitalists. You don't know anything about their beliefs by just labeling them fundamentalist. You have to look more closely. And then there is also the convenient habit of ignoring the fact that even liberal types like Andrew Sullivan make equally certain, supremely confident, non-skeptical claims about religion and moral truth. But one thing that really seems to escape their notice, and this is something that Dennis Prager has observed, that for the last 200 years, the religious views of Christian fundamentalists pretty much have been the dominant views of this culture. Yet on balance, it's produced nothing but liberty, prosperity, and freedom. So why, all of a sudden, the great fear that people like me and many people in this room are the great threat to the American way of life? I think things got twisted for two reasons. People have been taken in by what I call the myth of neutrality and the myth of tolerance. And I want to address that for the rest of the time that we have together. Let me illustrate what I call the myth of neutrality. You see, the notion of tolerance nowadays, the way it's played out in our culture, depends for its force upon a sense of neutrality, that we all take a neutral position with regards to everybody's point of view. But I think this is actually a myth. I don't think anybody's neutral. And I'd like to illustrate here by reading something that Faye Waddleton wrote a number of years ago, in which she expresses a moral point of view, a way of looking at things, how morality works in our culture. And I think it's largely an accurate view of how people view things in our culture, but I think it's extremely flawed. Now, Faye Waddleton and I don't really line up much on just about anything, but I'm not reading this to ridicule. I think she's done a great job of expressing a point of view. And as many of you listen to what I'm about to read, I think some of you will think, gee, I don't think I'm supposed to agree with what she says, but I don't know how I can disagree without sounding foolish. So let me read it to you, and you can decide what you think. And I think there's a problem here. I think that her views are deeply flawed, and I'll explain why in a moment. Here's what she writes. Like most parents, I think that a sense of moral responsibility is one of the greatest gifts I can give my child. But teaching morality doesn't mean imposing my values on others. It means sharing wisdom, giving reasons for believing as I do, and then trusting others to think and judge for themselves. My parents' morals were deeply rooted in religious conviction, but tempered by tolerance. There's our word. The essence of which is respect for other people's views. They taught me that reasonable people may differ on moral issues and that fundamental respect for others is morality of the highest order. I've devoted my career to ensuring a world in which my daughter Felicia can inherit that legacy. I hope the tolerance and respect I show her as a parent is reinforced by the work she sees me doing every day, fighting for the right of all individuals to make their own moral decisions about childbearing. Here, of course, she's talking about abortion on demand. 75 years ago, Margaret Sanger founded Planned Parenthood to liberate individuals from the mighty engines of repression. As she wrote, the men and women of America are demanding that they be allowed to mold their lives not at the arbitrary command of church or state, but as their conscience and their judgment may dictate. I'm proud to continue that struggle to defend the rights of all people to their own beliefs. When others try to inflict their views on me, my daughter, or anyone else, that's not morality. It's tyranny. It's unfair. And it's un-American. Close quote. Wow, that's pretty good. Very powerful. It sounds so sensible, so reasonable, and so tolerant, but there's a fundamental flaw. First, notice her emphasis implicit emphasis on neutrality. She says we should trust others to think and judge for themselves. Americans are demanding that they be allowed to mold their lives as their conscience and judgment may dictate. In other words, we should be morally neutral with regards to everybody's own judgments about things. Tolerant towards them. And if we're not neutral, we're not tolerant. Well, what's the flaw here? The flaw is simply that Faye Waddleton is not neutral. In fact, she errs in assuming there even is such a thing as morally neutral ground, a place that you can stand. in which you have your point of view, and you might report it to others by way of autobiography, but you never act as if your morality, or religious view for that matter, applies to somebody else. They're on their own islands of moral neutrality, and there's a space in between, and that space in between is called tolerance. And if you get off of your island and you start acting as if your point of view has anything to do with anybody else, then you violate the violated the neutrality and the dictates of tolerance, and people have a lot of nasty names that they call you, and they feel free to do so in the context of our culture. The problem is, Faye Waddleton is not neutral. She's not on neutral ground. Does she have the same neutral, non-interfering respect for views that differ from hers? Well, let's look at what she says. In her article, she implies we should respect another's point of view. She wants to continue to struggle to defend the rights of all people to their own beliefs, but then has this to say of those who believe, whose beliefs on morality are different from hers. She says they are unfair, un-American, and tyrannous. You realize these are moral labels, these are moral judgments. If you disagree with her view of tolerance, that all points of view are equally valid, then she will not tolerate your view. Here's another curiosity, the very first sentence. Like most parents, I think that a sense of moral responsibility is one of the greatest gifts I can give my child, but teaching morality doesn't mean imposing my moral values on others. Are we to actually believe that when Faye goes to little Felicia, she says, you know, Felicia, mommy believes in bedtimes and respect for elders and homework and choice and those kinds of things, but far be it from me to force my morality on you. No, of course, as a good parent, she's going to act as if her morality is the correct one. But she takes it further than that. Not only will she force her morality on her children, which is an appropriate child rearing, but she will force it on you. How do I know? Because she said so. Where? Right there in her piece. I have devoted my career to ensuring a world in which my daughter Felicia can inherit that legacy. What legacy is she talking about? Her point of view. And what does she do to ensure that her point of view is passed on from generation to generation? She's a lobbyist. She's in Washington, D.C., prevailing upon or seeking to prevail upon congressmen and senators to pass laws that reflect her moral point of view. It's as if she's saying, I have devoted my career to ensuring a world in which my point of view is enforced. And to put a sharper point on it, in May 1994, Congress passed a law making it a federal offense to block an abortion clinic. It doesn't matter to me what you think about that law. I'm making a different point. Pamela Moraldo, who was at that time the president of Planned Parenthood, had this comment. She said, this law goes to show, listen carefully to her words, this law goes to show that no one can force their viewpoint on someone else. Now, why is that funny? It's because all laws force a viewpoint. That's the point of law. And for legislators who don't believe in legislating morality, they should probably get out of the legislation business. That's the point of laws. Now, I have to make a clarification here. I am not objecting at all to anything that Faye Waddleton is doing. This is the American way. Everybody gets a voice. Everybody gets a vote. If you can prevail upon the powers that be with regards to your point of view, more power to you. That's the way it works here. I'm just making a different point. It's not neutral. Faye Waddleton's not neutral. Nobody is neutral. Neutrality is a myth. And it is this neutrality that drives the tolerance project as understood in our culture today. And it's this very tolerance project that is, I think, is creating the shrill tone. Let me give you a case in point. Because this whole thing obviously expresses itself not just in morality, but in religion as well. A couple of years ago, I was flown out to Toronto in Canada to do a show called Test of Faith. And in this program, it's kind of an interesting program because it's a TV show. And they have a large table that's kind of a semicircle table on the dais in front of the cameras. And it's like a donut cut in half. And so you have a small semicircle right there in the middle. And they have a chair right there. And the chair is for some weirdo they fly in who's got a strange religious point of view. And then they bring in three different people along with the talk show host on the outside of the four chairs to beat up on the weirdo for an hour in front of national TV, which is kind of interesting. Now, where do you think Mr. Coco was sitting? How was the weirdo in the hot seat? The topic of the show, though, was religious pluralism, and my weird religious idea was that I rejected the idea that all religions are equally legitimate ways to God. Now, this is very controversial in our culture, and to do so, of course, invites immediately the charge of intolerance. And, of course, I expected that in this show. And indeed, before the show even began, now this is not a religious program. I mean, it has religious content, but it's not run by Christians. It's called Test of Faith, and they thought, you know, people fighting about religious things would make good TV. So I'm talking to one of the folks in the background, one of the cameramen or whatever. His name was Peter. And he said, he's an atheist. And I said, and I was making small conversation with him. We were having a good time. And I said, Peter, let me make a prediction about the way this show is going to go. I don't know. I could be mistaken, but they usually follow a pattern. I'm going to go out and give an argument. That is, I'm going to give the reasons for my point of view. And people can judge whether they're good reasons or not. But what generally happens is people will ignore my argument and my reasons, will simply bypass that, and then they'll start attacking me because I'm a Christian who thinks I'm right about religious things. And they're going to start calling me names. Intolerant, arrogant, whatever. I said, I could be mistaken, but that's my prediction. Let's see. So the cameras start rolling, and I get on, and the talk show host, Valerie Pringle, begins to interview me for the first 5 minutes. I'm alone to make my case. Why don't you believe that all religions lead to God? I said, Valerie, I could argue this as a Christian and say, well, I'm a Christian and I think Christianity is true and therefore other religions are false. I mean, that's a way to go, I guess. But I'm not going to argue that way today. I'm going to argue as if I were an atheist. What I'm going to say is I can give an argument that is not dependent on my own religious convictions to argue that I think religious pluralism is a false view. And here it is. Jesus claimed to be the Messiah. He either was the Messiah or he wasn't. Now, if he wasn't the Messiah, the Jews are right and the Christians are wrong. If he was the Messiah, the Christians are right and the Jews are wrong, but under no circumstance can they both be right. If God exists, he's either personal or he's not personal. If he's personal, then the Jews and the Muslims are Christians, and Christians are right on that particular point, and the Hindus are wrong. And if he's not personal, the Hindus are right and the Jews, Muslims, Christians are wrong in that point. But under no circumstance can they both be right. When you die, you either go to heaven or hell or get reincarnated or lay in the grave, but you can't do them all at the same time. Thank you. Do you see that somebody has to be mistaken here? And now we're not talking about the number of angels that can dance on the head of a pin, are we? We're talking about points of view, elements in worldviews that are completely incommensurable. They can't both be right. Now, having given my argument, I said there are two ways that people on the panel might try to defeat my argument. That would be ways around this problem that I just identified, though I don't think any of them are going to take either of these two ways, and both of those two alternative ways have their own problems. But I left it at that. Okay, now it's time for the rest to come up. First person up was a Sikh. Gentleman for Toronto. Sikh is a religious order from India. The gentleman wore the turbans. And he was a barrister and an attorney from Toronto. Very nice in the green room. But now the cameras are rolling, it's a different story. She asked Mr. Singh, Valerie said, Mr. Singh, what do you think of what Mr. Kokal said? He said, oh, I think it's very fine. Very good if Mr. Kokal thinks he won the lottery. Good for him. I got to be careful with my Sikh accent because pretty soon I start sounding like a leprechaun. But notice how he starts. Mr. Kokal thinks he won the lottery. What's that have to do with? Does that have anything to do with the argument I offered? No, that's a shot at me as a Christian, as a follower of Christ. I think I'm right, but that's not on the table. We're not talking about Christianity. We're talking about pluralism. But that was his first comment. And, of course, the passive-aggressive nature changed very quickly to aggressiveness. And pretty soon, I'm the kind of person who starts wars and causes all kinds of problems and all of that, you know. And he's pounding the table and shaking his papers at me, and he's all angry. Then a Hindu pastor comes out and a liberal Christian from the United Church of Canada, all pluralists, and all taking essentially the same tone with me, although the Hindu pastor was a little bit more peaceful. Generally speaking, I'm the bad guy. because I think I'm right. You know, here was my observation to them. It's interesting, we started out this show talking about religious pluralism. But somehow the topic has shifted, and now we're no longer talking about this idea of religious pluralism. Now we're talking about Mr. Kokel's personality. Mr. Kokel's intolerant. Mr. Kokel's arrogant. Mr. Kokel's mean, basically, is what they're saying. And so I said, okay, let's all agree that I'm mean, all right? I'm the meanest guy in the world. Now we all agree on that point. Can we get back now to the issue we're supposed to be discussing, which has nothing to do with my personality? Do you see how the shift changed? Instead of discussing the idea, it's an attack on my character. Now, there's a name for that in public discourse. It's called an ad hominem. It's basically name-calling. Now, what if I would have said to the barrister across from me, the Sikh, Mr. Singh, you're right, I'm intolerant, and you're ugly. And your mom dresses you funny or something. I mean, would this have been an appropriate response for me? No, of course not. And he would have considered himself ill-abused if I had done that, and I wouldn't think of doing that. But how is that comment any different at all from the comment that he made to me? Both are irrelevant attacks on the individual, and they're disregarding the issue in question. In fact, I said, you know what? You think that I'm wrong, apparently, as a Christian. Well, maybe I am. That's certainly possible. I'm very comfortable saying this. Now, I'm not making it up here. I'm not just emoting. I have reasons for believing as I do, but I'm not God. I'm not omniscient. I could be mistaken about these things. But if it turns out like you're implying that I am mistaken, then Christianity isn't true, is it? And if Christianity isn't true, then all religions don't lead to God, do they? Therefore, if I'm wrong, I'm right. They didn't get it. One whole hour, they didn't get it. Now, the atheist got it. He came up to the stage afterwards, and he was livid. He was mad at the Sikh. He said, what's wrong with that guy? And he was using language appropriate for an atheist. I call this the passive-aggressive tolerance trick. Calling someone intolerant is not a meaningful or a substantive response. And let me tell you very quickly how to avoid this trap or how to get out of it if you find yourself into it. By the way, people say this all the time, and I don't think they're trying to be mean-spirited. I think they think this is a sound and reasonable response. They have been socialized to respond this way when issues of religion come up and people aren't entirely and thoroughly relativistic about it, pluralistic about it. So when somebody says that I'm intolerant, I always ask this question, what do you mean by that? Give me a definition. Why is it you're calling me intolerant right now? Now, I'm not asking in a belligerent way. I just want to get a sense of what they have in mind. And almost always they say this, well, you're intolerant because you think you're right. And my response is, yes, I do. Now, like I said, I could be mistaken, but let me ask you a question. Do you think you're right? Now, what's that person going to say? Everybody believes things because they believe the beliefs they have are true. If they didn't believe they were true, they wouldn't believe them. They'd believe something else, wouldn't they? Of course he thinks he's right. That's why he's opposing me right then. That's why he's trying to correct me right then. And so here's my follow-up question, and this is the one that matters. Why is it when I think I'm right, I'm intolerant, but when you think you're right, you're just right? What am I missing here? Now, I hope that sequence of questions demonstrates for you that everybody in the game has a point of view. Nobody is neutral and everyone thinks he's right. But as it turns out, in the present state of public discourse, and that's what I'm addressing now, only one side, in a sense, is allowed to say that they're right. The other side, when they act as if they're right, they're called names in the public square. Now, there's a reason why this kind of things happens, and the reason is that people are very confused about what tolerance actually is. And this is my last point. This happens because tolerance has been redefined. And I was able to make this point when I was speaking to some high school kids in Des Moines, Iowa, a couple of years ago. I was asked to come into a high school senior classroom of religion. It was a Christian school, and talk a little bit about this. So I wanted to talk about this and to warn these kids about the tolerance trick and to see if they have not, in fact, been taken in by this. And so I started talking about this issue. Now, you got to know, I don't usually like talking to high school kids, personally. We have a staff member at Standard Reason. That's his job. To me, talking to high school kids is like talking to a painting. You know, it's like, you know, they're just, I could say something that's so funny that, you know, adults are falling off their chair and they're sitting there like this. Are you going to laugh at this? Are you going to? We're not going to laugh, you know. Golly, you know. And so there they were, and they got in the, there were about 12 of them, they got on the far side of this table to face me, and they sat there like the Last Supper, you know. And I'm trying to talk to them about the tolerance issue. We finally get a definition of tolerance on the board. And the definition was, and I wrote this on the board behind me, all views are equally valid. I think that kind of works. If you have a view, particularly on morals or religion, that you think is right and others are wrong, well, then you're intolerant. That's the way that works. Then I turned around and wrote another sentence on the board. Underneath the definition of tolerance, which is all views are equally valid, I wrote this sentence. Jesus is the Messiah, and Jews who reject him are wrong. Whoa, them's fighting words, aren't they? In fact, here, even in this Christian gathering, a young lady was just coming right out of her seat. All of a sudden, you know, the Last Supper came alive on me. And she's waving her hand. You can't say that. Why not? That's, what do you think she said? Intolerant. And then she said, how would you like it if somebody said you were wrong? Think about it. See my point? No neutrality. I said, you, like you're doing right now, young lady? Doesn't bother me a bit. Why should it? Do you notice how the young people have gotten a clue now from this sense of tolerance that they feel they have a right to be angry if people disagree with them? Do you notice that? How would you like it if somebody said you were wrong? Doesn't bother me a bit. I'm a grown-up! I turned around and looked at both of the sentences on the board. In fact, I circled the first one. The definition of tolerance, and the definition said all views are equally valid, and I asked the group this, is that a view? Yeah? Good. Then I went and I circled the second statement. Jesus is the Messiah and Jews who reject him are wrong, and I asked them the same question. Is that a view? Long pause. Boy, this is a tough one. Finally, yeah, I guess it is a view. I said, boy, that's interesting, isn't it? If tolerance, properly and commonly currently understood, is the idea that all views are equally valid and that Jesus is Messiah and Jews who reject him are wrong, is a view, what must we say, given the present definition of tolerance, about the second statement? It is just as what? Valid as any other statement. Therefore, for the young lady who is objecting to the sentence on the board, by her definition of tolerance, she would have to be labeled and branded as what?
Intolerant.
Do you see the problem here? On this definition of tolerance, all views are equally valid, including all the views that say other views aren't equally valid. Put simply, all views are equally valid and not equally valid at the same time. You know what I call that? Confusion, right? This definition cannot work. It's because it isn't the right definition. It is a twisting of the old definition of tolerance. The classical definition of tolerance is almost exactly the opposite. And here's the way that Peter Kreft, a Roman Catholic thinker from Boston College, put it, and I think Peter Kreft has been behind this podium before. Here is the old view of tolerance, the one that is genuinely a virtue. He said, be egalitarian towards persons. What's egalitarian mean? Equal. Treat human beings as if they're equally valuable. Respect people. But when it comes to ideas, you are not egalitarian towards ideas. You are elitist. Now, the kids understood what elitist was. Elitist is a snob. What's a snob? Someone who thinks he's better than other people. Right. And so if you are elitist regarding ideas, you think some ideas are better than others. Now, why might we want to think that some ideas are better than others? Because they are. Some are good, some are bad, some are smart, some are stupid, some are foolish, some are dangerous. And we ought to have the freedom in the public discourse to talk in such a way as to figure out which is which without having names leveled at people who have, in a good faith effort, come to certain convictions about what those good ideas might be. In other words, we treat people with equal respect, but we treat ideas as if some are better than others. Right now, that equation is reversed. In other words, the current definition of tolerance is exactly the opposite of what the classical definition is. In other words, tolerance has been turned on its head, and tolerance has become intolerance. Because now we must treat all ideas as if they're equal, and if we don't look out, those who don't are fair game, and those people can then be abused with name-calling of all sorts. Now, I am not complaining that I happen to be the recipient of this, as have others. This is just the way of life for many of us, and it's not just followers of Christ who have been victimized by this. But what I hope that you've seen from the conversation we've had so far is that it is hard to have reasonable discussion about things that really matter, about the most important issues you can possibly imagine, ethics, values, religion, when there is a cultural habit currently of marginalizing certain types of views and doing name-calling to such an aggressive extent that much of the culture is now starting to believe that these who have contributed so much for the last 200 years to our culture and so much for the last 2,000 years to the good of the world are actually the most dangerous people on the planet. My appeal, simply, regardless of what your personal convictions are, please do not be taken in by the tolerance trick and don't play it on other people unwittingly. Be smart. Be responsible. Don't give in to the tendency of dismissing a view with politically correct name-calling like you're intolerant. Rather, address the issues, consider the facts, weigh the evidence, reflect on the reasons, think carefully because so much is at stake. And always remember that in the final analysis, when all the facts are in, when all the smoke is cleared and the truth is fully evident, the person you simply dismissed as intolerant may turn out to be the one whose views were right in the end. Thank you so much for your time this morning. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.